We're live and we're local. This is a Juno Afternoon on Wednesday, March 28th, 2018. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney, and on today's show, we'll find out about real spring fever with Aaron Heist. We'll also get a preview of this month's Alaska Design Forum with guest Skylar Tibbetts. And we'll get our weekly Eagle Crest update from Jeff Verclough. Those interviews, national native news, bird note, music, and more coming up right here on a Juno Afternoon. Quick look at the weather. Scattered rain showers with highs around 40. Tonight, scattered rain showers with lows around 30. But tomorrow, sunny, patchy freezing fog, highs in the mid-40s. National Native News is next.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A Montana civil rights panel is seeking to learn more about alleged discrimination impacting Native Americans, in particular with law enforcement and in the criminal justice system. Jackie Yamanaka of Yellowstone Public Radio has a preview of Thursday's hearing.
The Montana Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights called Thursday's hearing because it has follow-up questions to testimony it heard from its 2016 gathering on border town discrimination. Gwen Kircher chairs the Montana committee.
People are still subject to having racial slurs spoken to them by the authorities and the officials. So these are things that we need to investigate to get them changed.
It's an allegation that Billings Police Chief Rich St. John takes seriously.
Any type of discrimination or bias-based policing is illegal.
As well as against their policy and procedure, he says. St. John says any complaints filed are thoroughly investigated. Kircher agrees and praises St. John for that.
And any complaint that has ever been filed against the Billings Police Department that I have been aware of has shown that they have done exactly as they should, and there was no racial bias.
Still, she says, the Montana Advisory Committee wants to investigate the broader issue of how Native Americans are treated by the criminal justice system. Others who are scheduled to testify are officials from counties that border the reservations. This includes other law enforcement officials and prosecutors. Public testimony will also be gathered. People can submit their testimony in person, via email, via telephone, mail, or fax. The committee's findings will be submitted to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. For National Native News, I'm Jackie Yamanaka in Billings, Montana.
An Addiction Action Committee has been formed by the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. The tribes are seeking to reduce opioid and other substance abuse issues among their community members. The committee plans to focus on efforts to expand resources and increase access to prevention, treatment, and recovery services. In addition, cultural solutions will be developed to help in areas of public safety and drug court. In a press release, Tlingit and Haida President Richard Peterson says the opioid crisis is having a negative impact on his people. Peterson says the tribe plans to collaborate with various governments, medical providers, and other institutions. Tribes across the country are taking steps to tackle opioid-related problems, including by filing lawsuits against drug makers and distributors. A federal court Tuesday ruled the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services violated the Head Start Act when it reduced funding of more than $7 million for the Navajo Nation. The court ruled the agency owes the tribe an opportunity to appeal the decision. Earlier this year, funding was reduced from $23 million to $15.7 million following allegations of under-enrollment. The Navajo program with 90 centers is one of the largest tribal Head Start programs in the United States. The tribe says funding loss would require more than 100 layoffs, center hour cuts, and the closure of many Head Start programs. In Winnipeg, at-risk youth will soon have a 24-hour safe place to go, 7 days a week. The Canadian government announced this week plans to expand a youth resource center to set up the Safe Place program. It will be named after Tina Fontaine. Fontaine's case prompted Canada's national investigation into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. In 2014, Fontaine went missing and was later found dead in a river. The center will provide an alternative to the streets for young people and help them with support and resources. According to Indigenous Services Canada, Tina Fontaine's family is in support of it being named in honor of the teenager. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members fight against poverty while earning money for college and gaining skills, with rewarding service opportunities around the country and info at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista. When you file online for your PFD, every Alaskan can support great causes like National Native News. Just select KNBA-FM, Kewaunik Broadcast Corporation. With your support, you can help us make a difference in our community.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon. I'm your Wednesday host, Shelley Delaney, and my first guest is here representing Trout Unlimited. Welcome back to the show, Erin Heist.
Hi, thank you.
Hi, you're welcome. You're here a lot.
I feel like I'm here every week, which is great. I love this show.
Oh, we love having you.
Oh, thanks.
Erin, I've got a lot of questions for you. There's a lot of stuff to cover today. But my first question for you is, what is your best fish story?
Oh, gosh. That's funny because we actually were talking about best fish stories really recently. Probably my best fish story when I was a little kid, we caught a skate, which I had never actually seen before. When it came out of the water, it looked like just like a dinosaur. They have these crazy mouths that sort of reach out at you and full of teeth. And
whoa.
I thought it was amazing and super exotic and really exciting. And my dad was like, oh, you know, I think they make fake scallops out of skates. We should just keep it and try it and we'll cook it up and see how it tastes. And I guess skates have this, they have a really special slime that gets on everything. A special slime that's impossible to get off. And so, like, we spent hours cleaning up the boat afterwards. And then when we cooked it, it was maybe one of the most disgusting things I'd ever eaten. And it was just the whole package was really, really memorable.
Do they really make fake scallops out of skates?
I don't even know if that's true, but like I tell people that all the time because I remember hearing that when I was a kid. It seems like a really ridiculous thing to do with something like a skate.
But yeah, and not something you want to put in your mouth.
Yeah, later I was in New York City and I went to this really fancy restaurant and they had skate on the menu and I was like, well, you know what? If I'm ever going to enjoy skate, like, I'm in the place where they're going to know how to make it the best. And so I ordered it. And it was just the dumbest thing to do because my husband ordered something like lobster risotto. And I couldn't even eat it. I don't know
really?
What it was. Yeah. Like, I guess maybe I just had this, like, ingrained thing with skate.
Some trauma, some bad associations.
Some bad memories. Dinosaurs from the below. Yeah.
That's really interesting. I'm going to have to look up what those are later and do an image search. All right. So like I said, you're here representing Trout Unlimited. So what is Trout Unlimited and what is your role there?
Sure. So Trout Unlimited, it is a 501c3 nonprofit. It's a nationwide organization that has kind of a couple different branches, but the primary mission of Trout Unlimited is to conserve and protect cold water fisheries. So up here in Alaska, that means salmon and trout habitat. And in Alaska, we do a lot of work across the state that's really focused on making sure that salmon and trout continue in the state for eons to come. The other branch of the organization, so I'm an employee of TU and work on those kinds of conservation programs. The other branch is a membership program, and it's primarily fly fishermen. That's how the organization was started, and fly fishermen have been really great conservationists. The organization, I believe, was started in the 1950s. And so here in Alaska, we have the Juno chapter, or here in Southeast, we have the Juno chapter of Trout Unlimited. And it's a pretty active chapter. They do fly tying nights throughout the winter. They do casting nights during the summertime, free activities. They also do different kind of restoration projects. And they're a pretty active membership. It's a really cool organization. And also it's just like an opportunity for people who are into fly fishing to mm-hmm. get together and geek out about mm-hmm. fly fishing. So I definitely encourage people to look up the local chapter and potentially sign up or do one of their events because they're really good people.
Yeah, I like the free classes and all those things that are offered all year round.
Yeah.
And are there any specific campaigns that Trout Unlimited is working on right now that you want to mention while you're here?
Yeah. So as program staff, I work on a couple of different campaigns. And so one is the American Salmon Forest. And recently, we're focused on conserving salmon habitat in the Tongass National Forest specifically. And so we've done some organizing this spring around a couple of different proposals that were put forward by Senator Murkowski. And we're going to roll back some protections that have been placed on really high-quality salmon habitat in the Tongass. And we actually we came out with a win, and those protections are left in place, and we'll carry on to fight another day. But we had a bunch of people in Juneau who came to our event to see Rachel and the Ratfish Wranglers in February, and tons of people called, tons of people wrote in and spoke up for Tongass salmon, which was really awesome. And then we're also involved in the Salmon Beyond Borders campaign, and that's a campaign focused on our transboundary rivers, so the Taku River, the Stikine, and the Unik. On the Canadian side of those rivers, there are some major mines that are in development, and a couple of them are in operation, like on the Stikine River and a tributary of the Stikine. The Red Chris mine is a huge mine with a huge wet tailings dam. The pictures are insane.
A what?
It's a tailings dam, so it's like a giant earthen dam, and then behind that is like a huge man-made lake. Oh. And the mine tailings are underneath the water.
What are mine tailings?
So that is basically the mine, the processing that the mine has done. The tailings are kind of wet, gets pulled out, and that they get stored underwater for kind of in perpetuity. And behind this tailings dam and... So anyway, with the Salmon Beyond Borders campaign, we're really trying to get international conversations happening between the U.S. and Canada to take action on potentially mine reform so that we're really paying attention to what happens on these transboundary rivers, because these rivers specifically are really important to Southeast Alaska. They're some of the biggest salmon-producing rivers in the area. So, we're involved with that campaign as well, and recently also had some really great success there. Governor Walker and Lieutenant Governor Malott, as well as the full congressional delegation, spoke up on the issue, and we've got the State Department's attention, and we're actually having conversations that are feeling like we're going somewhere. So, yeah. And again, Juneau has just been awesome and supportive, and it's been a really interesting campaign to be a part of, so...
Well, congratulations on the successes. I'm happy
Thanks.
To hear that the protections won't be rolled back, and good luck with the good luck with the upcoming work. It sounds like it's quite a lot to take on.
Yeah,
I know that's what you do, but
it's been. I mean, you know, people here in Southeast Alaska, our lives are really intertwined with our salmon, and I think people really understand how important it is to speak up for what we love. And it's nice to see, like in this current climate, that people are really. Really making sure that their voices are being heard. And I think our elected officials are hearing that for sure. So,
and how many people are a part of the organization Trout Unlimited?
So here in the state, I honestly don't have numbers. I guessed earlier that it was a couple. I think it's probably closer to like 1,500 members across the state. We have about 10 staff members in the state of Alaska. And nationwide, you know, there's Trout Unlimited chapters in every state in the country. So it's a pretty interesting organization that's been around for a while. And again, it's really sportsmen who are just passionate about these fish and about these landscapes.
What about sportswomen and fisherwomen?
Sportswomen especially as well. Yes. Yeah. And that's really what we're here to talk about.
It is what we're here to talk about. I'm working up to it. So we're here to talk about Real Spring Fever, which will be put on by Trout Unlimited, and also Alaska Fly Fishing Goods, which is the fly fishing store right here in Juneau. It's awesome. What is Real Spring Fever? Tell us about it.
Yeah, so we've really had a lot of great conversations among Trout Unlimited about what we can do to help more women get into fly fishing. Fly fishing can kind of feel like, and I'm sort of speaking from my own personal experience, I found fly fishing to be kind of intimidating. It seems like it's kind of, you have to figure out all this gear stuff and the flies and the rod and the line.
And the technique.
And the technique. And I think that... I was talking to a bunch of other women in town and some women up in Anchorage, and we're just talking about what can we do to help more women feel comfortable about like getting out there and trying fly fishing. And the biggest thing we thought was like, well, I think networking is a big deal and that women learn from other women in a different way. And again, that's me speaking from my own personal experience. I learned to fly fish at the Becoming an Outdoor Woman workshop here in Juneau. And I was taught by Kayla, who's works at the Alaska Fly Fishing Goods Store. And she's the new Trout Unlimited chapter president as of last night. And she's this really awesome, like, great fly fisherman. And I just realized when I was learning from her that I think that I just learned differently when we were talking about how to fly fish. And I just needed somebody who was like, it's not that big a deal. Like, as long as you have a hook in the water, you're fishing. And maybe you didn't get it there the most graceful way. Maybe there's like all these different like random techniques that you could be learning about. But when you get down to it, that's how you fish. And I just needed somebody to say that to me. So we decided to put together this event where the first half of the evening, it's 5-minute skill building, and it's sort of round robin skill tables, all going to be taught by local women who are great fly fisher women. And it's going to be all the tables will be geared at like the most basic level, so like kind of a refresher skill building. And then if people want to get a little bit deeper, we can always have those conversations too. But it's going to be everything from like basic knots, what's your ideal rod setup, fish handling, how to land a fish by yourself, anything that we thought maybe could feel a little intimidating. And you know, I still consider myself a very beginner fly fisherman person. I don't even, it's funny. I always just say fly fisherman anyways.
Fisher person.
But I've been fly fishing for probably 3 years pretty actively. And all the stuff that we're going to talk about on Friday is all stuff that I need to hear every single year. We also think it'll just be a really good opportunity to network because I find when I go fly fishing, I am generally calling my dad. And I love fishing with my dad, but I would love to go fishing with other women. And so just helping people meet each other and in like this really comfortable, relaxed, like casual environment that's all about being a nerdy outdoor person. And even if you don't consider yourself very outdoors, again, like I think it's going to be a really fun night. And then the second half of the evening is all films that are featuring women who fly fish. And part of that is just to kind of get inspired and jazzed. And we'll have a film from local filmmaker Sydney Akagi and a film from Anchorage. And that's Pudge Kleinkauf. She's a longtime woman who teaches and guides up in the Anchorage area. And then we have a whole series from Costa, and it's kind of like a super high production, exciting film series of films of women just going and doing crazy fly fishing. So.
And Kayla's made her own film, too.
Yeah. So I think Kayla will be in Sydney Akagi's film.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the workshop part of the evening is round robin format. Mm-hmm. Can you explain a little bit how that works?
Yeah. So that just means that it's not like a structured sit down classroom style learning. It's going to be a series of tables and the skills will be 5-minute skills. So you just show up, go to whatever table looks interesting to you. When you feel like you have sort of figured out what you want to figure out at that table, you just move on to the next one. That kind of like casual, chit-chatty, easy, short skill.
Nice.
Also, there's cocktails because it's at the Rockwell Ballroom. So it'll also be sort of a cocktail mixer.
You mentioned that one of the round robins is fish handling. Will you have fish up in the ballroom there?
I have stuffed fish. That came in the mail yesterday, and they are awesome.
That's great.
I even had to make sure that they had adipose fins because I know there's some fish nerds out there who are really serious about adipose fins. And that just would determine whether a fish was wild or whether it was a hatchery fish.
I see. Wow. Yeah. Super interesting. Sam learned so much already. Well, that's fantastic. And I understand that all of the proceeds from this event go to Becoming an Outdoors Woman, one of the best programs that I've ever participated in. And that's how you and I first met.
Yeah.
So would you like to say a little bit about Bo, what it is, when it is, where it is?
Sure. I can say as much as I know. And Bo, Becoming an Outdoor Woman program, it's put on by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and I know they receive a bunch of supports from some other outdoor organizations. And the big event that they do in Juneau is a multi-day weekend that is all, I think, all like hour and a half long, or maybe even more like 2 or 3 hour long skill blocks. And so it's everything. Like when I did it, I did field dressing deer, fly fishing. I'm trying to remember what.
I did salmon fishing, firearms.
I know they do crabbing.
Archery, kayaking.
Foraging. Kind of any sort of outdoor skills.
Yeah, survival, map and compass.
Yeah, and it's just really cool. It's out at the Echo Ranch Bible Camp. And I know that the bow application program for that weekend, it fills up really fast. And I know the application is going to be live, I think, April
2nd.
Yeah,
oh, I checked
that. Good.
Yeah, I get the emails. Yeah. I'm a bow nerd.
Yeah, you kind of have to apply like the day the application opens up if you want to get exactly what class you want. But it's a really, really amazing program. It's super affordable for what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And they also, I believe, have scholarships, partial scholarships for folks who maybe can't necessarily afford the full fee for the weekend. I also, they've done a couple other, they do some other classes outside of that specific weekend, and I definitely highly recommend people go to the Fish and Game website and look up everything they offer. It's a statewide program, so they also have classes up north. But here in Southeast, last year I did their upland game bird hunting class, which was awesome. And we did a day in a classroom sort of talking about general things that you need to know when you go hunting for hooters. And then the next day we went and went hooter hunting, and I shot my first hooter, which was really cool.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. And it was just there. It's such a cool program. And again, it sort of really gets at that idea that women learn differently from other women. And it really helps. I don't know. I don't know what it is, but I feel like it helps to learn with other women and from other women. And it's just this really super friendly, great environment. And I guess I should say, absolutely, like the event that we're throwing on Friday and bow classes included, they're not exclusive. It's not exclusively limited to women. Anyone is welcome to come. We're definitely focused on getting women out there on the water and encouraging women to fish. But absolutely, everyone is invited to come and participate, especially for like the film portion of it. The cost for the event on Friday is $15. We've got tickets in kind of all the usual spots, so online and then at the Jack Carside and Rainy Retreat. And for everyone who comes during the skill building section, we've got some really great door prizes. Everybody who comes and participates gets a door prize ticket. And we have like a complete rod, reel, and line set that was donated by Echo. So you can come and win like your whole rod setup if you'd like. We've got flies donated by the Fly Fishing Shop, like a nice little box of flies, which is really awesome. We have like a sweatshirt from the Salmon Sisters. We've got these really cool fly earrings and a matching fly that you can then fish with while you wear your fly earrings.
I've had a lot of men tell me my earrings look like flies or fishing lures. I'm like, good.
Totally. Flies make great earrings as long as you take the barbs out. Yeah. So, I mean, it's just we're really excited about this event on Friday. I think it's going to be really fun. And we really hope we get a bunch of people out.
It sounds great. The door prizes alone are a huge draw. I know, you know, fly fishing, one of the things I think that's a little bit prohibitive is people are reluctant to invest in the setup. It can be kind of expensive.
Yeah.
But that's one of the things you can talk about with the folks at the Real Spring Fever, you know,
totally.
How to get involved on the cheap, if that's, you know, what are some of the resources out there? And
absolutely. And I think recognizing, I mean, like, almost every outdoor activity, there's always some sort of gear buy-in that you end up in. And I do agree that, like, I think on the outside, fly fishing seems like it's an expensive sport to get involved in. There's definitely ways to do it inexpensively to get started and see if you like it. And then once you get hooked, you know, then you can potentially figure out, you know, whether or not you want to invest in like a better rod or better reel or whatever. But I honestly, so I bought all my fly fishing gear at a garage sale, and I had like the jankiest, most ridiculous waders. Like, I was embarrassed to be seen in them. And then I didn't have any boots to wear over my waders, so I got these, like, glacier booties that the tourists wear over their shoes when they go on glacier trips. I found some of those at Salvation Army. But they would, like, fill up with water and hold them. So every time I came out of the water, I just had these giant, like, balloons of water on my feet. I looked like an idiot, but I still had so much fun. And yeah, I love fly fishing. I think it's one of the coolest ways to be outside. And it's a totally different way to be in this landscape. Like, I think people who like hiking or kayaking or any of that, and, you know, like any different way that you can be in Southeast Alaska is really interesting. And fly fishing is totally different and a really, really cool way to, like, interact with this place that we live.
Yeah, and if you're out with all your fishing buddies, female fishing buddies, you don't really mind if you look kind of silly walking mm-hmm. around with balloon feet or whatever.
Totally.
Or if your equipment isn't, like, top of the line.
Yeah, because so it's not, great. I don't know, maybe I'm speaking out of turn. It's not about looking cool. It's about getting to be out there and catch fish. And
Yeah. Well, you look pretty cool when you catch a fish, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, so if you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Erin Heist about Real Spring Fever. It's a fly fishing party, basically, at Rockwell Ballroom. Mm-hmm. So when is it? What time? Let's go over all the details one more time.
Yeah, so it is Friday, March 30th. That's this Friday. And we're going to start at 5:30 with a round robin five-minute skill session. That goes from 5:30 to 7. Everybody who participates gets a ticket for some really rad fly fishing prizes. And then from about 7 to 9, we'll be showing a series of short films. And the evening, our goal is to get more women out fly fishing, so all the skills will be taught by women. All the films feature really amazing women fly fishing, but everyone's invited, and it's $15 for the whole shebang. So whether you just come for the films or if you want to come for the extra skill building session, $15 gets you whatever you want to be.
Thanks for answering all my questions today. What's the best place to find more information on this?
Sure. Probably our Facebook event would be the easiest place. Otherwise, check out the Trout Unlimited Juno chapter Facebook page. And I think that's the best spot. And we've got tickets online at the Jack's website, or you can go to the Jack in Person, Hearthside Books, or Rainy Retreat and buy tickets in all those places, too.
All right. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, I think just hopefully we see a bunch of people on Friday. And if you can't make it on Friday, still reach out to us, especially if you've been thinking about fly fishing or you've been, like, fly fishing curious and just haven't made the leap. I'm organizing this event primarily with Kayla from the Alaska Fly Fishing Goods Store. And we both just, the number one goal is to get more women out there. And we're happy to sit down or chat or, you know, just talk about what that means. So please just get out there and fish.
Cool. Well, I'm happy I could help you spread the word today.
Thanks.
Thanks, Erin.
Bye.
There's a yellow moon coming up tonight, shining through the trees. Crickets are jumping and the lightning bugs are floating on the breeze. Baby, get ready. Across the field where the creek turns back by the old stump road, I'm gonna take you to a special place that nobody knows. Baby, ready. Ooh,
tonight. Baby, get ready. Ooh-wee. You and me going fishing in the dark, lying on our backs and counting the stars where the cool grass grows.
Cyrano de Bergerac, soldier, poet, and musician, is clever, charming, and disarming, but believes he'll never win the love of the beautiful Roxanne. Through strength and wit, he fills his life with love, honor, and panache. Perseverance Theater presents Cyrano de Bergerac by Edmond Rostand, a world premiere translation and adaptation by David Grimm. See it March 16th through April 14th. Tickets at the Jack, Hearthside Books, ptalaska.org, and 463-TIXS.
The station is supported by Breezin, carrying a variety of sandwiches, fresh baked bread, and pastries. Chef Moorhead offers daily changing menu choices for takeout and catering for special events and parties. More information at breezin.com.
You're tuned into a Juno Afternoon. It's about 33 minutes after the hour. I'm Shelley Delaney, and here with me in the studio is tonight's guest lecturer for the Alaska Design Forum. Welcome to the show, Skylar Tibbetts.
Well, thanks so much. Happy to be here.
Yeah, Sean Boiley is also here. We'll talk to him about the design forum a little bit and his role in that. First of all, Skylar, you are the founder and co-director of MIT's Self-Assembly Lab. What is the Self-Assembly Lab?
Yeah, so it's a lab under the Department of Architecture, and we're a research lab looking at different technologies from fabrication tools, how to print things, how to make new materials, and then how to make materials smarter and smarter so they can do more in our products or our environment.
And how did you get into that? What's your educational background? What was sort of your journey to get to that position?
Yeah, I studied architecture originally and then went to MIT for grad school. I studied then design computation and computer science, then became faculty years ago, started the lab. And the work is really the blending of those two worlds, design meets computing, or what it means to compute and embed information into physical things. So we're trying to make smarter physical environments that can make decisions, sense, actuate, et cetera.
Could you give us an example maybe of what you're talking about?
Yeah. So one of the probably most well-known projects we've done is something called 4D printing. So the idea there is that you want to 3D print something, but you want to add the element of time, so the fourth dimension being time, that you want to print things that transform, they reconfigure, they adapt, they evolve. So it's sort of like printing robots or printing smart materials. We print them, dip them underwater, and then they transform into things.
Wow. That's really hard to picture. Would you tell us a little bit more about smart materials or programmable materials is what I saw on your website?
Yeah, so there's a whole category of materials called smart materials. They've been around for quite some time. The problem with traditional smart materials is that they have kind of niche properties, and they tend to be expensive, they're hard to assemble, but they can basically transform themselves. It's a material that when you get it hot, for example, it'll turn into something. And what we try to do is take any material, wood, metal, plastic, foam, rubber, and make it a smart material. And the way that we do that is by fabricating it, like printing it, laminating it, laser cutting it, so that it has these new properties. So we can basically turn any material into a smart material.
Could you maybe tell us about some products that would be made with programmable material or smart material?
Yeah, and the reason we call it programmable is because we want to literally, like, embed information into it and program it to do different things like sense or actuate. And so you can imagine almost any application. Think about the clothes that you're wearing, your car, a plane, shoes, medical devices. We all want them to be smarter and smarter and smarter and do more. But normally that means add more devices, add more robots, add more cost, add more motors and batteries. And what we're showing is that you can use just simple materials like textiles or wood or metals or plastics the same way that we have them in our existing products, and now they can adapt to our body temperature. They can transform based on sunlight. They can move based on moisture. So they're super smart, highly active and adaptive, but they're just fundamental materials.
Wow, the future is so exciting. I've seen things on your website like chairs and tables that might be made of smart materials, mm-hmm. even spaces, mm-hmm. rooms or partitions for rooms that kind of look like.
Yeah.
So, but beyond that, what is the potential of self-assembly, of 3D printing, 4D printing, mm-hmm. additive manufacturing? What industries are using this technology?
Yeah, we collaborate with a lot of different companies in different industries, some in the automotive space, some in the aerospace, aviation sector, more consumer products like clothing and shoes. We've worked on projects there, medical devices, prosthetics, building materials. So it's a super wide range of applications, and all of them are about how to make materials smarter with less and less and less, less complexity in assembling, less devices, less energy, et cetera, and so that they can then adapt to us or our environment. So think about like shoes that can adapt traction or can morph to become more comfortable, for example, or become breathable when your body gets hot. So these are all functions that we can embed into materials, and then they can become, you know, seamlessly integrated into the product.
Where can I buy it?
Yeah, there's not a lot of these that are on the market now. Most of the companies we collaborate with are really on the forefront of research, and hopefully they end up becoming part of products and on the market soon. But most of it is like what's possible and pushing that kind of boundary of it seems like science fiction, but we can now do it today with existing materials and show how to do that.
What's your vision for some of this stuff? What's a product that you would like to have that's smart like that?
Well, coming from the architecture background, one of the goals would be scalability, like how do we make larger and larger systems? It also could be about scalability, how do we make more and more? Because often if you want to make something smart, you make one of them smart, and it's really hard and costs a lot of money, but you can make one thing. But if you want to make every brick in a building smart, there's different types of challenges. So I'm really interested in that. Like, can we make a lot of things or very large-scale things that can adapt to the environment or the climate, for example.
And how is this sort of technology going to impact our daily lives? Like, how far away are we from being able to purchase smart shoes?
Mm-hmm. I don't know about the shoes. I mean, one of the things is that it's a handoff with our research to our collaborators in industry. You know, we invent new things and develop new research, and then we have to partner with them to commercialize it. And so some of it is like, you know, how long it takes them to get the shoes out there, if ever. But there's a couple things that we've done, for example. So we recently put out a book called Active Matter, and one of the first pages in the book is literally active matter. So you put it in the sunlight and it morphs and transforms itself. So that's, you know, something that's on the market. We also spun out a company on programmable tattoos. So these tattoos, they change color. And they adapt their temporary tattoos, and it morphs based on sunlight, or it morphs based on body temperature or air pollution. So it tells you different things about your environment visually by adapting. So there's some things that are out there now, and then there's a lot of work that we do with other companies that are, you know, in research phases and hopefully make it to the market soon.
So taking a little step back and going into the, you know, old school 3D printing, which is not old school at all, but I don't know that much about it, but mm-hmm. everybody knows that it's coming further and further and further along. So this is a total amateur question here, and you can laugh if it's totally ridiculous, but I've seen 3D printing in use in some recent sci-fi movies, and I was wondering if that could ever be a reality. Like, is it more efficient to transport a printer and its materials to make anything with it into space, or even just, you know, on Earth, mm-hmm. than it is to transport the actual goods, for example, food products?
Yeah. There's a lot of different benefits for 3D printing. One of them is local production and transportation. So you can transport a file basically free across the world digitally, and then you can produce it locally where you need instead of producing it offsite and shipping it. There's a lot of reduction in logistics and complexity of getting goods around. So people talk about that. There's also the argument for customization, that all of our products today are pretty much static. They don't adapt to anything, and they come and fix shapes and sizes. But if you wanted a pair of shoes that's only for you, or a piece of clothing that's only for you, or a piece of furniture that's designed exactly for you, digital fabrication or 3D printing more specifically allows you to produce things that are customizable. But what I'm more interested in is using 3D printing as a sort of material science chamber. So it's a really unique process that allows you to deposit different materials at the same time. And because of that, it's sort of like alchemy. You can create amazing things because you have control over the placement of materials that you couldn't have done in other fabrication processes. So to me, that's the most exciting. Yes, there's all these other kind of interesting advantages like customization or transport, but that's where sort of science fiction becomes reality in this material science chamber.
All right. Now, getting back to you yourself, you've won many awards throughout your career. Can you say which award or perhaps which personal accomplishment has meant the most to you?
Oh, that's a tough one. I've been fortunate to be a part of amazing organizations. And so, some of the fellowships, for example, like TED Fellowship or National Geographic Explorer or Wired Fellow, they're awards, but they're also kind of lifelong partnerships with these organizations, and you meet other amazing explorers that are like traveling the world and doing amazing things in the oceans or in space or in forests, and we're kind of humble researchers doing weird stuff in a lab. So those opportunities are really inspiring because you get to meet other people and then start to form collaborations, think about the world in a different way. And then they become a platform. So like TED, for example, when we presented the work at TED, the 4D printing work in 2013, that like launched a lot of collaborations and really like kickstarted the career. So these are amazing opportunities and huge honors to be part of.
How did you get connected to the Alaska Design Forum? Speaking of world-class collaborations, have you ever been a part of it before?
No, this is the first time and first time in Alaska. I think it was the sort of cold call email, do you want to come to Alaska and present? And it's like, definitely. Never been here before. Sounds awesome.
And how do you like it so far?
It's amazing. I think we got super luckier in Anchorage than Fairbanks and now Juneau. Saw the Northern Lights, went skiing, walked on glaciers. Like, incredible experience.
Is there anything that you encountered here that you'd never seen before?
I mean, just the scale and the kind of extreme diversity and like breadth of the outdoors is wild. I live in Boston, grew up outside of Philly, mostly urban settings. And so like the scale of the mountains flying through them, or like the sound of the glaciers cracking and like the noise that it makes, these are all things that you just don't experience every day. And so those are just like super memorable.
Yeah. Well, perhaps you should consider relocating your lab.
Exactly. I'll ask MIT if they want to come to Alaska.
All right. Well, what will you be covering in your talk tonight?
So I'm going to talk about all the work that we do at the research lab, the self-assembly lab, and there's basically three main categories. So there's all the work on self-assembly, which is how individual parts come together on their own to build structures without humans or robots. So sort of future of fabrication, future of construction, far out kind of scenarios. The second one is all the programmable materials work that we talked about and the 4D printing work. And then the third is about phase change. How do you make things go from solid to liquid, liquid to solid? And we invented a new printing process called rapid liquid printing, and I'll show some of that. So tons of visuals. It's kind of hard to describe what we do verbally, but all the videos and images like really bring it to life.
Excellent. Well, what are the details of the talk tonight? Sean, I'm kind of turning to you on this one.
Oh, okay. So background, those of you who don't know, it's Alaska Design Forum presentation and a series called Automata, which is addressing technology and people and sharing the space of these things. And this is the Alaska Design Forum's 25th year in production and bringing visitors such as Schuyler to our great state to help us in our own journey of development and building our future up here and by looking to what other people are doing in the world. Skylar's presentation is our second to last in the season. We have another in April, April 11th. We have a 1010 studio coming up. But as far as what's happening tonight, 6 o'clock at the K2 360 North studio.
That's right here.
That's right here.
And you're early.
I'm guessing this is probably going to be about an hour presentation.
Yep.
Discussion.
Yeah, and Q&A.
And it might be a great opportunity to talk to Skylar directly and ask questions about this type of technology and research and development. It's really pretty exciting stuff and very directly applicable to our life in Alaska, which, you know, if you look at how industry develops here, we tend to be both let me put it this way. A lot of new stuff gets developed up here in our industries in our state, and seeing what is newer than what we're doing is a great opportunity to see what we may do in the future. So,
and there's a lot of extreme scenarios here. Like, it's hard to get equipment and materials and extreme weather. And to me, that was just striking. And those are the kind of opportunities and environments that we're interested in, like where traditional manufacturing construction are not the best way, and we need to radically rethink, like, what are other ways that we could put things together, other ways that we could make, other ways that we could build.
Correct. And there's a, you know, high degree of customization to most anything that gets built for these places. I mean, the three cities that you've been in, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and now Juneau, have completely different climates when it comes down to it. And so when you think of an article of clothing or a piece of building technology that would be mass-produced somewhere else in the world, it's probably not going to be perfect for all three of those sites. But when you get into products that can self-change to be appropriate for climate conditions, that's what's exciting to me as an architect.
Yeah. Yes, exciting to me as well. I don't think I'm understating it if I say, like, you're part of the future. You're going to change the world. So we'll start with tonight and your talk.
Humble beginnings.
Well, I don't know about the Alaska Design Forum. It's a pretty big deal, so not super humble. But anyway, the talk is tonight, 6 p.m. at 316 North. That's right here in KTOO Studios. And Skylar, where can we find out more information about you and about your work?
Yeah, you can go to our website, selfassemblylab.mit.edu. You can look at all the research we've done. And as I was saying before, there's tons of videos, so it's super, super visual. And the moment you see the video, you're like, oh, that's what he's talking about. Yeah. It's super hard to grasp otherwise, and just a lot of nice visuals there.
Great. And Sean, where can we find out more about the talk tonight and the Design Forum?
So on the Alaska Design Forum website, that's alaskadesignforum.org. Look it up. There is a small fee associated with attending the presentation. It's mostly to cover our organization's costs of bringing our guests to Alaska. It's pretty modest. I think it's $15 per adult, $5 for students, and anyone that needs a break, well, my company gives them a break, covers the costs. So we just want to have people to feel free to attend to partake in this. And think of any kind of entrance fee as a contribution to this greater future that we're developing here.
Cool. Do we need to purchase tickets in advance?
Nope. Just at the door.
Okay, great.
And we're going to have somebody there at 5:30. If you want to come in a bit early, that'd be great. Classic Juneau, I can guarantee you it probably won't start till 6:05.
I don't know. We run a pretty tight ship here at 360 North.
I don't know
if you noticed. No, that's that's a good point. And yeah, you got nice weather for an indoor talk, so that should be good. I expect you'll have a good turnout. Skylar, I did visit the website, the MIT Self-Assembly Lab website. It's amazing. So anyone who's curious should go and check it out. And is there anything else that either of you would like to add?
No, just really looking forward to it, and such a privilege to be here. It's been an amazing experience so far.
We're very glad to have you. Thanks for coming.
Thanks.
From my heart and from my hand, why don't people understand my intention? We'll be right back. in my endurance.
This is Bird Note. Visit a shallow wetland in summer, and you may be dive-bombed by a slender black-and-white shorebird with outrageous red legs. The appropriately named black-necked stilt has the longest legs, relative to its size, of any North American bird. It uses those legs for wading, as it picks tiny insects and crustaceans from the water surface with its long, slender bill. If the stilt continues to pester you, you must be near its nest. These birds signal the approach of any potential predator. They leap into the air and call with an intensity and volume all out of proportion to their delicate appearance. The persistent calling signals that the predator has been seen and often sends it on its way. Thus, the stilt's noise and activity benefit all the birds in the vicinity. Because of this, black-necked stilts are called sentinel birds. When avocets, which breed in the same habitats, add their voices to the clamor, you can understand why no sensible predator would stick around. Birds of shallow wetlands, stilts are very sensitive to drought, which has increased with global climate change. But they readily move to new breeding areas, responding quickly when new wetlands are created. To see a photograph of those outrageous red legs and learn what's being done to conserve wetlands, come to our website, birdnote.org.
Join me, Troy Quinn, and the Juno Symphony as we seek to soothe the soul with a program of divine and inspiring music on Saturday, April 7th and Sunday, April 8th at JDHS. Vaughan Williams' familiar English folk song suite sets the mood as we travel across Europe to a work inspired by the majestic Swiss Alps. The full orchestra and the Juno Symphony Chorus, along with the Juno Douglas High School Choir, are assembled to play Fauré's life-affirming masterpiece, Requiem, featuring world-renowned soloists Zenaida Robles and Jarrell Williams. Tickets are at Hearthside, The Jack, JunoSymphony.org, and at the door.
Hey, Folkfest fans. KTOO wants your favorite festival-related photos for our public art show, Folk Life. How about that great picture of Buddy Tabor, a scene of kids dancing at Centennial Hall, a late-night jam session? You're invited to send us three images that will hang on our walls for the month of April. The show will be super simple, no frames. Just email your three images to arts@ktoo.org by March 30th, and we'll print and hang them. Details at ktoo.org.
You're tuned into a Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney, and with me is Jeffra Clow with our Eagle Crest update. Welcome, Jeffra.
Thanks for having me this afternoon, Shelley.
Of course. I know not everybody was excited to see a winter storm on Monday, but I'm betting you were.
Oh, yes. It's always good to see snow, and we did get quite a bit of snow up on the mountain. We got a little over 10 inches at the top of the mountain and about 7.5 inches at the base. However, it did warm up, so that 7.5 inches or so kind of feels more like 2 inches, but that's okay. That's what happens in the springtime.
And were you open to enjoy it? I know spring break was wrapping up.
Spring break wrapped up, and we closed on Monday, so we were closed on Tuesday, Wednesday.
Okay.
So we're expecting a little bit of a powder day tomorrow. So the mountain will be closed for avalanche control work from 6 until 9 o'clock in the morning, so no uphill hiking. That way patrol can get out there, make sure the mountain is safe, and everybody can then have a great morning of powder skiing.
Excellent. Well, that's good. That was good news. And then how did spring break go for you guys?
Spring break went well. We were just happy to have snow. So, you know, we've had a lot of kids in spring break camp. A lot of people came up and were able to get some skiing in. Of course, the weekend was a lovely weekend. Sunday was absolutely fabulous. And there's a number of people up there enjoying it. And, you know, the season is winding down. It's hard to believe, but we only have 9 days left of the season.
That is hard to believe.
We encourage everybody to get up there while you can, because the season is going away.
Well, what's left to do up there? What do you guys have planned for these next 9 days?
Well, of course, we've got some great skiing and snowboarding still, but Easter is Sunday, April 1st, and we've not been open for an Easter in about 5 years. So we're really excited for our annual Easter celebration. And so we're going to invite everybody up. We're doing something a little bit different this year. We're doing a kind of an upper mountain digital scavenger hunt. So you have to go look for eggs, post your picture of the egg on Instagram, and then there'll be some prizes for that. So we'll have all of those details on those rules for that scavenger hunt on the Upper Mountain posted on our website. Should be posted by midday tomorrow morning.
That sounds super fun.
Yeah,
what a great idea.
So totally different. And
Easter egg hunts, not just for kids.
No, not just for kids. But then for the kids, we'll have a scavenger hunt on Porcupine. And if you find all of the things on the scavenger hunt list, then you can visit the candy station and turn your list in and get an Easter egg. So we're looking forward to that. 12:30 on Sunday, we're going to have a bunny and a bonnet contest. So we're inviting everyone, make your Easter bonnet or create your Easter bunny. Come on up. There's going to be judging. We're going to have the best in show, most creative, overwhelming, amazing, and some great prizes. And then we've got the bunny annual bunny chases. So we'll do a bunny chase on Porcupine and two bunny chases on Hooter for younger kids and then for older kids. So that's that purple bunny's going to be hopping its way around. And then we'll finish up the day with a bunny toss at the bottom of Muskeg.
What is that? We only have a few seconds left. Can you say what that entails real quick?
It's a plastic white bunny that you toss for distance.
Gotcha.
Find all the information at skijuno.com.
Thanks, Jeff. And thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon today. Jeff Brown's the producer. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. The show is available on demand online at ktoo.org. Tune in again tomorrow.